just because people feel that they need to buy guns doesn't necessarily mean it's valid, right? Like, I think every country feels that they should have nuclear weapons, but we should ensure that every country doesn't get them, right? I think, like, this idea that if everybody's feeling unsafe, that's like a civic breakdown.
Well, I feel like we did have a civic breakdown, and this is the result of the fact that there were guns out in the streets and people felt like, you know, that's an obvious reality and I want to have one in a legal, sensible way to protect myself.
Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Robbie Gupta.
I'm Corey Bradford.
And I'm Ricky Schlott.
Well, a few announcements on the front end of today's show. Number one is we just launched our newsletter. It's The Lost Debate newsletter. You could subscribe on Substack or by going to the Lost Debate website. And essentially, this is a long-form opportunity for us to dig deeper in some of the stories that we cover every day on the show. And the first newsletter is actually about the investigations into Donald Trump. And in that newsletter, I just write about some of the problems with the New York Attorney General's investigation and the Manhattan District Attorney's investigation into Trump, and why it's like one of the biggest undercovered stories going on right now, and that it could be one of the most important factors in the 2024 election. So subscribe there. The first 1,000 subscribers will be free, so get there as soon as you can. We also have an announcement about our video. So we have an incredible video team here at The Lost Debate, and they work really hard to deliver a YouTube video that is our full episode, as well as discrete segments that we do, and we release those after every show. But we're growing as a company and supporting new shows that are gonna be launching in the next few months, and so we're gonna be releasing only some of the segments every week on YouTube, and we're going to be still releasing the entire episode on podcast. So if you want to listen to the full episode of The Lost Debate starting Thursday, you can get it on our podcast only, and our YouTube page will just be for a few segments each week that we think are just some of the most compelling segments that we have. And so with that, Corey, what do we have this week?
On today's show, a bad quarter for Netflix and a streaming service that didn't even last for one quarter, CNN Plus. We'll bring you our dispatches from the streaming war front. Disney has a plus too, but they have a definite minus in Florida as Governor Ron DeSantis revokes their special tax status. Some sobering data from 2020. Apparently, it was the worst year on record for gun deaths among children. We'll get into why that might be. And finally, we'll discuss a classroom controversy in our favorite city, San Francisco, where a teacher brought in raw cotton plants to teach kids about slavery. But first things first, a billionaire, a bird, and a buyout. Elon Musk is officially taking over Twitter. And pending any dramatic twists, which given the main character in this story, wouldn't be a huge surprise, this is a done deal. $44 billion will take the company private, and we should all expect some real changes to the platform as a result. We talked about this back when it was more of a hypothetical, but now this is really happening. And Ricky, I'm assuming that given this news, you're still down with the world's richest edgelord. Are you still a Musk fan?
I am still a Musk fan. I like a lot of his goals here. Obviously, we don't really know how it's going to work out in practice. And he's changing a platform that already exists. And so there's definitely going to be growing pains. Like, I'm not confident that this 100% will work perfectly, but I like what he set out to protect free speech on the platform, to make algorithms open source so that there's transparency and trust about what's going on behind the scenes and why we're seeing what we're seeing, to get rid of spam bots and to authenticate everyone who's using Twitter. And
love
so
that idea.
I think all of this is great. I'm excited to see how it works in practice. Obviously, he's enormously successful. He's not done an adventure quite like this in a social media sense, but I'm optimistic and I look forward to seeing what happens here.
Yeah, I think the big question is going to be, can he make this company profitable, and doesn't even care about whether it becomes profitable?
He says he doesn't, right? Which is kind of great because he's the only person who can say something like that and say, here are my principles and this is more important than profits.
Well, I wonder, because they have lost, since going public, $860 million. They've had 33 earnings calls and 14, only reported a profit in 14 of them. And I wonder, in a world where the Tesla stock isn't performing as well as it is right now, is he going to be putting pressure on this company to actually produce financial gain for him? At least in the meantime, like you're saying, he's signaling otherwise. But he's also signaling that he's going to get rid of advertising while also potentially having people be able to pay for the subscription. And I think most analysts look at that and say that that would be a net revenue drop for Twitter. So an unprofitable company could potentially become even less profitable.
Yeah, I'm not paying money to venture into the cesspool that is Twitter. And, you know, Elon Musk has a record of being able to take struggling companies and make them profitable. I mean, he did that with Tesla. And Twitter is definitely, like you just said, a struggling company. I just want to point out from the insider intelligence, TikTok has more than 600 million monthly users and is growing exponentially. Facebook has more than 2 billion active users, even though they have been stagnant lately. Instagram has over 1 billion active users. Snapchat, 420 million monthly users. Twitter, 338 million monthly users. Snapchat has more people using it per month than Twitter. And only 25% of Twitter users tweet daily. So 75% of the people on the app aren't even actively using it that much. Maybe they're just on there, you know, absorbing the content, but they're not actively using it. So he has a real task in front of him to turn this boat around.
Yeah, Twitter. And it gets to the, you know, what's the cachet of Twitter, right? It's not how much money it's making, especially if you have a ton of money like Elon Musk. It's the influence it has with the most elite people in society. And that's why people, you know, when we at Lost Debate made a decision early on that we're going to start investing more in TikTok than Twitter. We barely tweet as a company. You still follow us, but we barely tweet as a company. A lot of people in the media are like, why TikTok? Because they're not concerned with TikTok because it's not monetizable and it's also not where their friends are. But that's where a lot of the youngest people are. That's where a lot of the growth is happening. And so when I look at Musk, I think he's thinking about this being like the sort of school cafeteria that he wants to own. He wants to control it. He's obviously been obsessed with Twitter for a long time and is very successful on the platform. And I think he wants the influence more than anything else over that group of people. Even though it's not the biggest group of people, it's some of the most powerful people.
Yeah, it's definitely a consequential group. And I mean, media, politics, everything, all the online discourse surrounding those issues is pretty much exclusively on Twitter with some outgrowths elsewhere. And also we've seen like just the power culturally of a Twitter mob and how even if it's just a small number of outraged people, they can destroy lives or change policies. And so it's a powerful and potent minority of Americans who are on this platform. And so I think that making it as pro-free speech and hopefully helpful towards democracy as possible is definitely a good thing.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that, especially blue check marks who are on the left, are getting upset over this. Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm wondering is, here you have a renewable energy entrepreneur who's coming in and saying that he wants to get rid of advertising, right? Potentially, is gonna be, I would say, super skeptical of data mining practices and like is talked about opening up the algorithm. You know, these are things that I think people are asking of other social media companies. Like these are left-wing critiques of Facebook that they should do things like open their algorithm and make it less sensationalized. So I'm wondering if people are going to come around to some of the changes that he's making to this platform.
It just seems to be like a weird fault line with the culture war because in my mind, Elon Musk, he kind of reminds me of like a Joe Rogan or even a Dave Chappelle. Here's a guy who's not really that conservative, but because he has said some things that conservatives like and liberals hate him for it, conservatives, you know, are really pushing him as this guy who's going to, you know, do everything they want him to do and save free speech online. And I really don't understand why the right loves him as much as they do. And I equally don't understand why the left hates him as much as they do.
I think the left pushes people like this into the arms of the right because they're inhospitable.
It's like a purity test of like if you have one opinion that's not just down the mainstream corporate buttoned up line, then you're relegated to the other side. And I think that it says something about the right that like for a lot of people, I don't have to agree with you on everything, mm-hmm. but because we have some common ground and there's some nuance that, I mean, that is sort of a positive that they're open to different kinds of thought.
Yeah. And here's another, you know, sort of thing to wrap your head around is that this, you have people on the left now basically defending the existing board of directors and leadership, which is weird. Like they're defending a corporate CEO and a board of directors who own virtually no stock, you know, especially compared to Elon Musk and other institutional players, don't even use the platform, most of the members of the board. But most of the people, as this sort of deal was shaping up, it was kind of the board versus Elon Musk. It's not that anymore, obviously, now because they've negotiated a deal. But it was weird to me to see the left line up with people like Robert Zoellick and, you know, venture capitalists over a guy who uses the platform transparently and has ownership in it and is talking about getting rid of advertising is very strange to me.
Well, speaking of struggling platforms, the best way to describe the swift demise of CNN Plus is just another three letters, DOA. Even before the Warner Discovery merger took effect, incoming management circled the struggling streaming service. The new CEO put CNN Plus out of its misery almost immediately, and we've seen a lot of people dancing on its grave this week. But that aside, it's an awfully good question. Ricky, was CNN Plus ever a good idea to begin with?
I think the answer is almost definitely no, but CNN's leadership was touting it as a completely distinct experience, the biggest milestone since the company's founding. They were making daily and weekly shows, but also branching out into like lifestyle content with cooking shows and stuff, and trying to essentially pull their weight in the streaming space in a way that Fox has done. Fox Nation has been relatively successful, but ABC, CBS, NBC, they're already doing free streaming. And so this is a super competitive space. And they invested $300 million into this project, which is an enormous. Two-thirds of that was in advertising, and hired 500 employees. Most of them were new acquisitions to the company as well. But then Warner and Discovery merged, and the new leadership of their parent company in this larger merger just said, this is not working. This is not a profitable plan. And so they shut it down less than a month after its launch. And at that was when they had 10,000 daily listeners, which is like 1% of CNN's daily. That's a drop in the bucket considering how much they've invested into this. It seemed like the writing was on the wall for quite a while, and this has been kind of a disaster.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's worth mentioning people losing their jobs probably over this. And you never want to see people struggle in this way.
Yeah, of course.
And so I think like part of in covering this, what we want to do is say, what can we learn from this and what happened versus being like gleeful about it, which we'll get to. There's a lot of people dancing on their grave, as you mentioned. But I think to me, it's like their best show, in my opinion, was this Scott Galloway show. And I love Scott Galloway. And I think when I saw that they picked him up, I was like, oh, this could possibly have legs. But then I realized Scott Galloway has two podcasts. He has the Prof G podcast and he has the Pivot podcast, which he puts out twice a week. So I'm like, and those are free. So I'm like, why are people going to pay $5.99 to sit around where, you know, you listen to your podcast, you can walk around, you go in the subway, you could listen in your car. Like, why do you need this streaming service to give you somebody, and this is true of a lot of the properties that they had CNN Plus, these are things where you can get this stuff elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
So I think that this was an idea that maybe would have had legs 10 years ago before there was a huge saturation of this market, but now it's just too little, too late. And like you said, like launching 2 weeks before a merger seems crazy.
Terrible,
yeah. And there was like, you know, obviously a huge divide within the old leadership and the new leadership. The new leadership came in and was like, basically like, let's consolidate everything potentially in streaming under one service, which makes a whole lot of sense. And I would imagine that we're probably going to see that in the year or years ahead. Is they're going to create one bundle of all these different services that they have.
Yeah, they'll probably end up combining HBO Max with Discovery Plus or some.
And maybe CNN, like, you know, put all this stuff together, you know?
Yeah.
Which is also curious as to why they didn't keep some of this, because a lot of the stuff has been paid for already. Like a lot of these contracts, they're going to have to pay out with the big talent, right?
Yeah.
Why not keep some of this stuff alive, bundle it, with HBO Max and Discovery, like you said, but I guess it was so expensive. They were going to talk about $750 million future spending on this.
It sounds like some of the shows might just merge back into the CNN, like major network, which makes sense because now they have a test case of what was more successful and what
that
wasn't.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Well, I think the reason they didn't keep a lot of these shows is because, like you said, Robbie, you can get this content elsewhere and it's stuff that CNN isn't really well known for.
Right.
I mean, like Ricky said earlier, they had cooking shows. If I want to watch a cooking show, I'm going to go to the Food Channel. They had business shows. I can just go to CNBC. They had sports shows. I mean, there's ESPN for that. And they even had
never mind like Barstool
exactly.
And The Ringer and The Athletic. You mean
absolutely.
Go on, right?
And then they had a book club. They had like Jake Tapper's book club was one of the shows. Now, I'm not going to sit and watch 30 minutes of Jake Tapper comparing the whale and Moby Dick to white supremacy. I'm just not going to sit and watch that for 30 minutes. I can just figure that out by reading the book myself. But speaking of all of these streaming services that aren't doing as well or streaming services that are having problems, there seems to be a war among all these different platforms. There's so many different choices. voices out there. Netflix reported their first drop in global subscribers in more than a decade. The streaming service lost 200,000 subscribers during the first quarter of 2022 when they predicted to grow by 2.5 million. And this has been all over the news. There was a drop in their stock price, a pretty significant drop in their stock price. And it's really just showing that Netflix was once and really still is the king of streaming services. And now all these streaming services like Disney Plus, HBO Max, Apple TV, they're all kind of taking bits and pieces out of their throne.
Right. And full disclosure, the Netflix CEO, Reed Hastings, is a donor to the Lost debate. And so I just want to make sure our listeners know that as I dive into the story. But I think obviously this was a surprising development to a lot of people. But I think if you peel back and you think about what we were just talking about with CNN Plus, there's a saturated market. It's not just a saturated market for news, but it's a saturated market for all streaming entertainment. And when you go back to 2013, when Netflix started doing original content, there weren't a lot of other people out there creating original content for streaming services.
Yeah. No one really.
They were basically alone in that respect, right? And so now everybody's gotten there and they have to fight a different kind of battle. Now, I don't think they're in as bad a shape as people are making it out to be. Like, they have more than doubled than where they were 5 years ago. Their international growth is amazing. Like, there's not a lot of people, if any, of these American companies producing steady content, for instance, in Latin America or in India or a lot of these other places where I think you're going to see Netflix grow dramatically. I think they might have reached saturation point in the United States, but there's just so much more to be done. But obviously, this is a moment for them, and I think they've lost some of their swagger, and I think that's going to matter as they try to gain talent within Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think it's also a drop following the pandemic when essentially anyone who wasn't on Netflix who might have wanted to be signed up, I would imagine that was probably the prime time when we were all watching Tiger King. And now, I mean, there's only so much growth that you can get. And they're also talking about potentially cracking down on password sharing, which I know a lot of people are upset about, but you know, that does make sense. Yeah. But then you also have like someone like Amazon where almost everyone basically has Prime today. Right. And so you already have a streaming service just bundled in there. So the competition is getting steeper and steeper, that's for sure.
But how many streaming services are people really willing to pay for? Some data tells us from the Kantar Group that 85% of U.S. households subscribe to at least one streaming service and that the average U.S. household has five of them. I have eight personally. I don't know why. I don't even watch but like three of them. So like how far does this go before it just becomes a point where now it's just like cable. You're pretty much paying as much as cable.
Well, I do think a lot of people like me where I have 10 and I probably pay for one. And I think this is what they're going to try to crack down on.
You have 10, but you pay for one?
Yeah.
Oh.
So I think I think what's going to happen here is what happened with newspapers in the early 2000s where they were a little loose. And any, like, if you remember back then, they either didn't charge or it was easy to piggyback on other people's accounts, stuff like that. Now it's like pretty strict about how you get information from places like New York Times, et cetera. And I think you're going to see more and more restrictions. There are obviously some like HBO Max, I think, for example, there are restrictions in how many accounts you can create and how many could be signed on at a given time. This stuff is pretty simple. That will immediately add a ton of subscribers in all likelihood to Netflix. But in the end, like, in my opinion, like the expectation of quarter over quarter rapid growth, to me, it's almost like people who buy Bitcoin and expect it to just only go up, right? Yeah. Like the trend can be pretty positive and it could tell a story about something, while you shouldn't always expect quarter over quarter growth. So I'm not as alarmist over this, but I know that a lot of people within Netflix who have stock options, this is a huge deal for their talent retention because a lot of these people are not going to be able to exercise those options. They're kind of worthless in a world where the stock isn't going up from the date that they're given them. So that's going to be a big deal for them as they try to retain talent.
Yes, absolutely. So moving on to our next story, the feud between Disney and the state of Florida is heating up. Within a matter of 3 days, Florida lawmakers introduced and passed a bill that will strip Disney World of its special tax status. Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill into law last Friday. But who this bill will negatively impact more, Disney or Florida taxpayers, is still up in the air. Ricky, how did we get here in the first place?
Well, so as we all probably know at this point, the fault line is whether you see this as the parental rights and education bill or the Don't Say Gay bill, and the critics see it as the latter. But essentially, this is just banning discussions about sexual orientation or gender identity from K to 3 in a fairly vague way. So there is valid criticism, I think. And Disney,
and we covered that, by the way, yes, just to let our audience know, we'll link that in the show notes.
And so Disney, as one of the biggest companies in Florida, was originally just trying to stay out of the political issue here. But with mounting pressure from employees and also just from the public, they ultimately came out and made a stance against this bill. And they vowed to essentially do everything they can to fight back against it. And so now Ron DeSantis has retaliated, saying that they don't run the state, essentially. They don't control it. And so he is stripping their special tax exempt and special district status.
What does that mean, Ravi? Like, they're getting stripped of their special tax status.
Yeah, these special districts, I think, are not well known, but they're widespread. You know, over the past few decades, four decades, states have created more than 8,000 new local governments. Of those, 96% of them have been these things called special districts. And these go back to the days of FDR. And there's a whole history as to why they were created back then. But Walt Disney, when he created Disney World, you know, he was like a famous control freak. He wanted to have full reins over the area that they were creating, Disney World. And that meant the ability to develop their own infrastructure, to basically call the shots. And that has been the law of Florida since the 1960s. And obviously, there's been a symbiotic relationship between Florida and Disney World. And obviously, DeSantis isn't even hiding the fact that he's stripping Disney World of this status as retaliation for their political position. And I'll get to why that could be problematic for him, but this will take effect June 1st, 2023. The big unresolved question is who's going to foot the bill now? Because basically what the special district means is that Disney World is running their own services, but also paying for their own services in large part. And there's like some of the services are covered by the county, some by Disney World, but there's hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars at stake here. They run their own fire department, land use, yada, yada, police force. And wow. Now you have two surrounding counties who are ringing the alarm bell saying, well, we can't afford to foot the bill for Disney. And so there's a lot of chaos. My sense is over the next year, there's gonna be a lot of negotiations over how they're gonna split these services, and you might potentially see property taxes go up. And one of the tax assessors in a neighboring district said they can go up pretty significantly.
Yeah, and what is that gonna mean for DeSantis? I think that the key issue here is that DeSantis did this in kind of a smart way, if you can call it that, because he's in an election year now, but the tax hikes won't occur until next year.
Yeah.
So it's not like people are going to see that before he's up for re-election. So it's very possible that he can just use this as a way of saying, hey, I took on Disney and won, and then people don't see the real effects yet, and then still win re-election. I mean, he's up pretty high in the polls right now in Florida.
Yeah, he's actually improved his standing over the past year. He's now has an approval rating in the mid-50s and a disapproval at about 40%. And even though I am a critic, and people can go back to the previous segment on the Don't Say Gay bill or the parental rights bill, whatever people want to call it. I'm a critic of that bill, but the polling on that is not as definitive as a lot
Definitely
of people who
not.
Are critics think. And there is actually some evidence that more parents in Florida support that bill than don't. And so he views this as he doesn't view this as a political liability. I think he views this as an asset.
Yeah, definitely. Overall, there's only about 26% opposition in the state to the bill. So it is fairly popular. And I can sympathize with the mindset of this one large corporate entity doesn't overpower the way that people in Florida feel. And I do sympathize with that sentiment. And I also sympathize with the idea that special districts can be kind of shadowy, weird, like self-governing entities that are exempt of taxes and aren't answerable to the voters around them. And so I think that those are both good, valid arguments. But I don't like this like very targeted retaliatory thing, because it just comes off as authoritarian.
Right. Yes.
And the optics are not great on that. But I do agree with the essence of some of the mindset behind it, because it is true that this corporation, it to me feels irresponsible to say, oh, we're vowing to overturn something that happened in the governmental level.
Right. To me, it's not like, I think he's like, in the end, these special districts need scrutiny. So for example, you know, here in New York, you have Nassau County, which has 140 different special districts, which cost the average homeowner $1,000 a year, and they hold their elections in inconvenient off-year times and typically have less than 5% turnout in these elections. So they're totally unaccountable.
Mm.
But this isn't about the special districts, right? It's like saying, like, you know, a local police force has like a beef with somebody and follows them around until they break a traffic rule. It's not about the traffic rule, right? This is about retaliating and making somebody's life as miserable as possible because of their political positions. And I think he, like, DeSantis could have exposed the state to some legal issues here, because there is some precedence saying that withholding a benefit because of political speech is unconstitutional. There was this case from 1996 called O'Hare Truck Service versus the City of Northlake. And essentially, this was a city that had a rotating system for assigning towing services. And one towing service refused to give a political donation to the mayor. The mayor won. And then they pulled him from the rotation. And the Supreme Court in 7-2 said, no, like, you can't withhold this service or this opportunity from somebody because of their political speech. And so that would be the precedent that I would use if I were Disney challenging this in the courts.
Absolutely. What happened to the conservatives that were against using the government to overregulate businesses?
This is Jared Polis, you know, governor of Colorado, essentially, I think, not didn't even essentially, called DeSantis a socialist and basically said, come to Colorado, we're going to be business friendly. I think you're seeing a different, you know, he's a different sort of Democrat in the way he talks about this kind of stuff. He's kind of Eric Adams-esque in that sense, like business friendly. And I do think there is this debate around what is the role of government vis-a-vis big corporations, and it's getting really muddy right now.
Yeah, and I mean, I personally am definitely allergic to this like corporate activism stuff. It just feels strange to me to hear a corporation speak as a representation of a state or of their employees or anything like that, to be honest. But I do accept that that's part of the free market. And I would have liked him to have said, you know, we're going to investigate why we have these 1800 special districts, including the Disney one, because that's a ton. And maybe some of them need to be reeled back and scaled back. But just to do it in such a targeted way, I'm not a fan of.
Well, yeah, I now invite DeSantis to the populist fight. I imagine now he's going to stop taking corporate donations altogether now, because he doesn't think corporations should be getting involved in politics.
Do we really think Disney's going to move to Colorado, though?
The problem is they need to be in a warm weather state. And how many warm weather non-Republican states are there, you know?
Arizona,
Republican state
maybe.
Is necessarily going to do this, but like, you know, like there are only so many places they could go. And obviously,
go back to California.
Obviously, it's just be next to Disneyland. Too expensive to move, you know?
Yeah, like, no,
they're going to have to figure it out, which is why I think Florida knows they've got them. But in the end, it could cost Florida more than Disney here.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely could. Moving on, for the first time, guns have become the foremost killer of kids in America. Cars, once the leading cause of death between the ages of 1 and 19, have been replaced by firearms. As it stands, 4,300 young Americans died from gun violence in 2020. But kids aren't alone. More Americans died from guns during the first year of the pandemic than any year on record, totaling 45,222 deaths. While homicides and crime led the surge in gun-related deaths, suicides and unintentional deaths also saw sizable increases. We saw a lot of gun purchases and new gun owners during the pandemic, so we're back asking an old question with new urgency. Ravi, does America have a gun problem?
I think it absolutely has a gun problem. I think what you do about it is the interesting question. There is a debate about how much new gun sales are contributing to this surge in gun deaths of children and gun deaths generally speaking. And there is conflicting evidence out there. There was this this data from the ATF that was cited in The Atlantic, which essentially showed that there is a record number of gun crimes being committed by new purchases happening, and those are on the rise. Now, there's all sorts of questions around that data, and that in a way conflicts with a peer-reviewed study in injury epidemiology that basically did not find a correlation between new gun purchases and increases in crime. And to me, this is almost besides the point. Like, to me, it's like if you took 100 aspirin pills and then you took the 101st, you're still going to die no matter what. And the dosage has gotten so high that each successive pill doesn't matter. That's how I feel about guns. We have so many guns on the streets of this country that to say whether it's new gun purchases, old gun purchases, there's just too many guns here. To me, it's almost irrelevant whether it's the new ones or the old ones. We just need to get more of these off the streets and come up with sensible ways to make sure they don't get in the wrong hands.
Well, I think that there is some relevance to whether there's new guns, because I think that people's motivation for buying guns during the pandemic especially were really valid. A lot of people felt insecure and unsafe given all the unrest that was happening socially. There's a case to be made that in one sense, this has been behind the rise of death of children under the age of 12. So since we have an additional 3% of Americans with guns in their households, that's obviously going to increase the amount of children living in a household with a gun and the liability of that. And so it seems that did correlate with the under 12 injuries, because that just makes sense. But then to the study that you were pointing out, they found that job loss, school closures, civil unrest, economic change are better predictors, which makes sense in the kind of teen demographic. If kids aren't going to school, if they've lost jobs, if their family's struggling for money, I mean, people are finding themselves in much worse circumstances during the pandemic. And I think that is definitely behind the rise of gun violence.
Yeah, I do wonder though, you say like it's, you know, it's because of people's fears about civil unrest, you know, that would make sense if there was just this one surge in June 2020 and at no other point, right? But I think like if the data suggests that there were increases in gun sales before June of 2020, then I'm like, all right, it's not just civil unrest, but also just because people feel that they need to buy guns doesn't necessarily mean it's valid, right? Like I think every country feels that they should have nuclear weapons, but we should ensure that every country doesn't get them, right? I think like this idea that if everybody's feeling unsafe, that they all need to arm, that to me is like a civic breakdown. Like we should probably have a public policy to prevent that.
Well, I feel like we did have a civic breakdown, and this is the result of the fact that there were guns out in the streets and people felt like, you know, that's an obvious reality and I want to have one in a legal, sensible way to protect myself. And a lot of, during the pandemic, a huge portion of the new first-time gun owners were women. And I think that is just demonstrative of the fact that a lot of people felt insecure, myself included. I mean, I'm not a gun owner, but I definitely at some points in the pandemic felt unsafe and potentially like it would have been nice to have been able to defend myself against, in a world existing in an ecosystem where there are a ton of guns out there, and me, whether or not I have one, is not going to change whether or not someone else with bad intentions has one.
Yeah, I think the only thing is there's been a lot of guns in the American ecosystem for many, many years, many, many decades before the pandemic. I mean, obviously I can see what you're saying. People felt insecure and felt unsafe during the pandemic, but they were inside mostly. So, I mean, people felt like maybe somebody would break into their home, things like that. I think the biggest thing when we talk about gun violence in America is that we always talk about the guns, but we never talk about the root causes to why this violence happens. We never talk about economic inequality. We never talk about mental health. We never talk about the lack of conflict resolution skills that so many people have in this country. Why is that never a part, or at least not a major part of the conversation? It's always about the actual weapons themselves.
Right, but I think to me, it's both, right? There's that, you know, the argument, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people, or, you know, that there's a wider societal issue, whether it's mental health or, you know, a lot of the trends that you're describing. We need to attack all of these issues. You know, to me, it is troubling, though, that people from, you know, conflict-torn countries are sending their doctors to places like New York and Chicago to learn how to treat gunshot wounds. That's embarrassing for our country, you know? And so to me, that means that we need to do better here. And most Americans agree with me. Over half of Americans favor stricter gun laws. And that doesn't mean no guns, right? We do have the Second Amendment, but the Second Amendment says, you know, it talks about a well-regulated militia and it talks about arms. And everybody, including the Supreme Court, says that that doesn't mean that this is an unlimited right. Like, once again, you can't have a shoulder-fired missile, right? Like, we should—
Not yet.
Yeah, so to me, like, handgun, sure. Like, should we have people who have machine guns and semi-automatic rifle? I don't know. Probably not. A lot of these things are too dangerous. Most people think that the mentally ill, we need to do more to prevent them from getting guns. Most people think we should have a federal database. Most people think we should crack down on these gun shows and the loopholes of the gun shows that are like flooding streets of New York and Chicago with guns, like this iron pipeline, right? Like, most people favor these things, but we don't have them because we don't have the political will to do anything about it.
Well, it's a twofold problem. On the one hand, gun culture in this country is really centered in rural areas. And in those areas, they don't see the same levels of violence that New York and Chicago sees.
Right.
So in their minds, they're getting guns for hunting. They're getting guns for sport, protecting their homes. They don't understand about that iron pipeline that feeds the violence on the streets of Chicago and New York. And also, I believe that a lot of people look at that violence in Chicago and New York and say, oh, that's that mayor's fault or that's the politician's fault. They don't understand that this really is a problem. The fact that guns coming from outside these cities are going in and going into the hands of people who probably don't know how to use them very well and are using them in extremely large, you know, amounts because they don't know how to solve their problems otherwise.
But what do you need these some of these weapons to hunt, right? Like some of these weapons are not hunting weapons. And like in some states, you can have armor piercing bullets. I'm like, why do you need that to hunt?
That's to protect their, you know, that's to protect them from tyranny,
yeah.
Ravi. That is to protect their liberty and their freedom, Ravi.
You know,
because the government, you know.
But that's what I'm saying is like, what is the Second Amendment about, really? Like the Constitution doesn't even mention hunting, by the way. So I get the sport of it all, but like, I'm not sure why I even care whether somebody wants to hunt or not. I get the cultural argument, but like, there's no legal right to hunt, you know?
Like, I don't think the Second Amendment's about hunting.
Right. Yeah, but it is about a militia, right?
It's about fighting tyranny, if that comes to bear.
And you know,
there's a question about, well, of course our military today has so much more than guns. Like an armed militia is probably not going to stand up to anything, but I mean, in the end, I'm for some common sense gun reform, of course, but I think that the Second Amendment is an important thing as well. And so I think that it's unfortunate that our dialogue has moved so far away from compromise, because it seems like people are really all or nothing on this issue. And yeah. I think that there are common sense reforms, even if that does mean, you know, prosecuting gun-related violence appropriately and consistently, which is one argument to be made, especially with a lot of progressive kind of light on crime policies lately. But you know, I mean, it's a complex issue, and I agree with you, Corey, that there's so many social things that end up getting kind of glossed over, even the war on drugs and like larger, deeper causes and roots here that just don't get talked about.
But I don't think it's an all or nothing equal both sides thing, right? Like, it's not like there's this flood of successful gun control legislation over the past few decades. It keeps getting blocked, like including some of the sensible things that I've described. Like, there, in my opinion, is one side that has very successfully blocked anything, and including they're so successful that the Supreme Court is blocking local legislation from people like in places like Washington, D.C., and potentially in places like New York. You know, the electorate wants stricter gun control, but it's getting harder and harder to do it, right? It's not like we have this wave of legislation that's successfully passed and stopping people from having any guns. It's the opposite.
Well, in Washington, D.C., that was overruling that citizens could have handguns in their own homes, right?
Yeah.
Am I correct on that?
Yeah.
Well, then, I mean, that's overruling something that is directly in conflict with the Second Amendment. That's not overruling like a common sense, like let's put a background check on whether someone's mentally ill. That's overruling, yes, you can have something in your own home as a private citizen.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Like, same people, you know, who appointed most of these Supreme Court justices are preventing things like background checks, the gun show loophole, et cetera. And that very same Supreme Court very well may basically overrule almost essentially the entire gun control regime in places like New York and allow things like concealed carry. And to me, that's like Wild West stuff. That's not what the electorate in New York is asking for right now. Never mind the fact that gun control in New York is meaningless in a world where we have these gun show loopholes. Like, the guns on the streets of New York aren't being sold in New York. They're being sold elsewhere, and we can't stop it.
Yeah, and gun control is also meaningless in New York because all the guns we have here are illegal, and you know, nobody that actually wants to go through the proper process can go and carry a gun with them, which is unfortunate because we've ended up in a situation where lawful citizens are unarmed in many situations and they're defenseless against people who are breaking the law. And it's a really sad, disturbing situation.
Yeah, I think, I guess like your solution is, all right, then like make it easier for people to have guns to meet the illegal guns.
No. That's
like,
not my solution.
Not
it's just a
guns.
Really, well, I mean, yeah. How do you say, okay, let's not have anybody get guns, because that's clearly not working.
Well, I think
even in more strict cities where that's where a lot of the homicide is happening and occurring.
Well, I think to me, I agree with some part of Heller, which says that this is not an unlimited right. And I think where you and I probably draw the line is in a different place. To me, like New York is like, the way New York is implemented isn't great, because basically you have to bribe a police officer to get a gun permit, or at least that's how it used to be. Whereas now there should be, in my opinion, really strict rules and regulations to get guns. Like, it should probably be harder to get a gun, stricter controls on guns in most places in America than Sudafed, for example, which is not true in a lot of places in this country. And so to me, I would say, hey, like mental health check, way stricter tracing of bullets and guns, et cetera, better databases, close the gun show loopholes, fewer people have guns, you have to make a case for having a gun. To me, that still would withstand Second Amendment scrutiny. I imagine that's not where a lot of people draw the line, but I still think like that's a world better than where we are right now to me.
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate just that when you implement some of the reforms, I mean, some of them are just basic common sense. Like, I agree with like basic background checks and mental health checks, and I think that that's completely fair. But the unfortunate reality is, in a world where you implement stricter gun control, those stricter controls harm lawful citizens and don't harm people who are potentially dangerous and willing to break the law. And it's, and I'm not saying that that means that we should just unilaterally dismiss all gun control arguments, but that's just an unfortunate reality. It's the same situation with any sort of prohibition. Unfortunately, when you try to knock something down, even if there's a moral reason and an ethical reason to what pops up in its place, is often a lot more dangerous and a lot more damaging.
Yeah, you know, we made murder illegal because we didn't want people to kill people. So,
well,
not necessarily like, oh,
it's,
you know.
That's an action. I'm talking about prohibiting, like, the drug war would be an example of that. When you, I'm not that we should just have like total open carry everywhere. Like, I'm not that much of a purist on this, but I think it's unfortunate that that is ultimately the reality that we face.
Well, coming from a state that has open carry everywhere, I can tell you that it really is a mental health issue. Until we fix the mental health issues in this country, and the reason why so many young people, especially so many young people who are African-American, want to pick up a gun to solve their problems, until we start addressing that, then pretty much everything we just discussed is kind of moot, in my opinion.
It, what's funny to me is people with this gun control debate, it's like they wouldn't make this argument about other arms. Like, it's not like people would be like, people should have a tank, right? Like, so everybody draws the line somewhere. And to me, it's like, how fast can you shoot your gun? How many bullets come out of it? And how crazy are you? Like, these are things that really matter to me. And like, the sense that like, you're an unstable person who can easily get a gun that can spray 1,000 bullets in a minute or whatever, I'm making that number up. The fact that we allow this in this country is insane. And anybody who's arguing to keep that regime in place, which is not you, Ricky, but there are plenty of lobbyists who've worked really hard to keep it in place. To me, I'm way more concerned about them than the people in DC who are saying don't have a handgun. Like, that wouldn't be the law I write, but like, I'm way more concerned about the former scenario.
Absolutely. Well, let's move on to a little bit of a lighter subject, but it might cause just as much controversy. A teacher in San Francisco brought cotton to her classroom as a part of a lesson on slavery. The goal was a tactile learning experience, but the main outcome has been an outpouring of outrage. And it's not coming from the right, mad about the CRT aspect of this, so much as the left, who's mad about it being insensitive. So I'm just trying to figure out, who should I get mad at? You want to help me out here, Ravi?
I think, I just don't know. This easily, like, this could have been a CRT story, right? Teacher comes in, gives students cotton, says this is what it feels like, and this is what it felt, this is, gives you a
raw
sense.
Raw cotton, which is raw, important to point out. There.
Which it gives you a sense of a little bit of just what somebody who endured slavery experienced. And it wasn't the right who got upset. And like, it could have easily have been a right-wing critique saying, hey, you're making these students feel guilty. Mm-hmm. But it was the left that got upset. And to me, this is just incredibly confusing. Like, what's the difference? Like, there's gradations of difference, obviously, but showing photos of slavery, describing it in vivid detail versus handing out cotton, I'm not sure why everybody's getting so upset over this.
Yeah, my first instinct was I thought it was like a right-wing outrage issue.
Right.
And this is also, it's important to note that these are eighth graders too, so they're not really young kids. And I think that, I mean, I probably wouldn't come up with the idea myself, but I see what the teacher's doing and the idea of making it a tangible experience that kids can somehow connect to. I don't know if it's the most graceful choice of how to do that necessarily. Right. But to put this teacher on leave for 5 weeks and all the outrage surrounding it, I think that's misdirected. There are bigger fish to fry, for sure.
I think the right didn't get so outraged by this because
they didn't get there first. That's why.
Well, but this happened in San Francisco. There's no right-wing people there.
No, but they're hunting. This is not to make it about it. The right wing has been fine on this, to be clear. This is not a what of both sides. But the funny thing about this is if they hadn't fired this teacher over this, you could very much imagine somebody, you know, Chris Rufo or somebody learning about this and using this as an example of CRT.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they fired her. They just put the teacher on a 5-week suspension of some kind. And she ended up coming back and making an apology for it. And then I think what the controversy was there were several parents. One parent said this in particular, putting raw cotton in the hands of children, including students of color, recreates conditions that evoke so many deeply hurtful things about this country. So
doesn't that remind you of something, that quote? Doesn't that remind you of the things that they're saying?
Precisely like a CRT argument.
Yeah, like you're making students feel guilty about our history of our country.
I feel like
I don't think she said guilty. I think she said evokes deeply hurtful things about this country. I mean, that's a little different. Like, that's a little different from, okay, if you're doing some lesson that's supposed to make white children feel guilty, that's a little different from doing a lesson that makes black children experience the horrors of slavery. Not to saying that this lesson was doing that, you know, but I think that's the comparison.
The legislation didn't say white people feel guilty. It says make people feel bad about their race. And so I think like, or feel guilty about their race or something like that. It didn't say white, obviously, in the bills. And so to me, this is like, you know, obviously she's just giving a quote to the reporter. I imagine she means more than just the words that are in here. But to me, like this feels like it could have gone either way is my point.
And I think to your point, what the argument is that the right or the left's argument generally is that more conservative people are trying to wash away that sort of pain that this person is discussing here. And, you know, this might not have been the most graceful attempt, but that was an attempt to introduce that into the classroom and to make it tangible and real, which seems to be what people who are against the anti-CRT movement are in support of. But this seems, the whole thing is just a little too culture warsy for me, but.
So what if the teacher only made the white students pick the cotton?
Yeah.
Then would we?
Well, then we're talking about the right wing problems.
They'd have a field day with that.
This is what I'm saying. I'm a known friend to teachers, obviously, as I've well established on this podcast. I don't know how teachers get this right anymore. Like, there's just no getting this right. Now, like, I know this is San Francisco, where they're probably less concerned about being fired for having CRT in the classroom, but people are hunting and pecking for anecdotes all around the country, and nobody wants to be elevated to a national sensation.
Yeah, you don't want to end up on Libs of TikTok.
Right. You don't want to be on Libs of TikTok. So if I'm a teacher, I'm like, wait, okay, like, I need to be woke enough so that I'm explaining history and the depths and the nuances of it in a way that satisfies, you know, my own innate sense of trying to get the history right, but also the pressures on me and my community. You know, a community that's taking Dianne Feinstein's name off of a building because she's not woke enough, and Abraham Lincoln, you know, that's San Francisco. And then at the same time, I've got, you know, people who are weaponizing these anecdotes all around the country. And so if I go too far, I might be plucked out of my city and on Fox News tomorrow. And I'm like, I don't know how I win.
I totally empathize with what this teacher was trying to do. I don't think you need to necessarily recreate history or even try to recreate history in order to teach it properly. And might I just add, this story reminded me of when I was in fourth grade and I had to go on a field trip to see Jefferson Davis's house in Montgomery, Alabama. Jefferson Davis was the only president of the Confederate States of America. So, yeah. This wasn't as bad as that.
Yeah, but okay. But like, you know, one of our staff members pointed out like this idea of tactile teaching, right? Like, it's not uncontroversial, right? Like, I think the lesson that one of our staff members was talking about was that he was in a situation that is often a left-wing curriculum where it's like everybody stand together. If you have this privilege, move forward. Yeah. If you have that privilege, move forward. And then people are in different places in the room, and you're basically like, this physical distance signifies like some kind of, you know, something more meaningful, right? Mm-hmm. And that tactile experience is important to the lesson. Now, I don't necessarily love the lesson that he described, but I imagine the school district did, you know, based on some of the things that they're saying. So I'm like, well, what kind of tactile lesson is good and what kind of tactile lesson is bad? I'm not sure. And it seems the teacher's confused too.
Yeah, but if you get to the World War II segment in this class, I mean, what is she going to do next, you know?
Like, well, I think in Ricky's school district, we'll give them live grenades. I'm just kidding.
On that note, we want to thank you all for watching this episode. Make sure to subscribe to our YouTube page. And if you're listening to the podcast, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. We will see you guys next time.